and they came, and those guys come and they make the best workshops for these guys. What was cool actually originally was that they had come separately, and those were two of the kids, you know, the guys' most favorite time that we had workshops was when those two had come. So I just want to big up those guys. I really appreciate them coming out. I also want to thank Kathleen and Brittany from Hope Partnership, the folks here at KBOO. If it wasn't for those folks, we wouldn't be able to do the type of stuff that we do out there. So I just want to thank them, as well as our engineer Mike tonight, who has done a great job on the board. So you've been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Community Radio, and I've been your host, Carlos Chavez. Stay tuned for more grassroots programming here on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be the sponsor of the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place from July 2nd through the 5th at Waterfront Park in Portland. The Blues Festival includes cruises like the Blue Bayou Cruise, the Rock the Boat Dance Cruise, Drifting Blues Cruise, and the Sail On Sister Cruise, as well as after-hour performances featuring Galactic, Charmaine Neville, Big Bad Voodoo Daddy, and the Paladins. Again, that's the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, Thursday, July 2nd through Sunday, July 5th at the Waterfront Park in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.fm/Waterfront Blues Festival 2015.
Every Monday night at 8 o'clock, you can hear this voice alerting you that
you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a two-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music. Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut? Here on KBOO Portland.
The River Signal.
It's practically standing still.
An original radio story written and recorded on the Channel Princess as it floats down the Mississippi. The River Signal features music and voices recorded on the bow of the paddle wheel riverboat and is inspired by our conversations with the performers we meet along the way.
Following 10 seconds of silence.
5 days in the sky.
I mean, I think that gets to the heart of what art, and I mean especially poetry and double especially spoken word, is all about, is like how we take our very specific experiences, because the specificity is what makes them real and what makes them engaging to an audience, and how we move that into a space of, one, how can it relate to multiple people that don't share that specific experience, but also how can it comment on these larger ideas and larger themes. I think what that does too, it emphasizes every individual's like agency, like the power that we have, not as people who are within like the tides of history, but as people who make those tides.
Episode 5, The Lock, featuring Guante. The last time I saw a storm like this, I was out in the salt flats, alone. 100 miles of gray skies and ash. I lost my tent and bedroll to a band of selectmen and When the sky turned yellow and opened up, there was nothing to do but hold my coat over my head and keep walking. This morning, though, I'm warm, up in the top bunk, looking at rain-streaked windows. I can't believe this boat. We found it 10 feet underwater. It had probably been down there for years. But now, even under this rain, it doesn't leak anywhere. Yesterday was a good one out on the highway. Saw several flocks of mandazuki overhead, scraped the bottom on a few sandbars. But right around sunset, the water got weird. Frothed up by a strong countercurrent, like we were getting pushed and pulled at the same time. I was hoping it was just a prelude to this storm, but now the clouds are scattering, the rain letting up and the channel's still churning. I've got a feeling that the water here, it's always like this. And anyways, I don't have the luxury to wait it out. I need to get to the Delta and find my folks. I rouse Reed and the envoy, and soon we're on our way. The current's even stranger than last night. I ask the guys to step to the bow and mark depth and watch for debris. Reed all but skips out the door, but the envoy limps dramatically across the cabin. He must have really hurt his knee back on the farm. That, or he's just a huge baby. As we move downstream, the storm lets up, leaving a shroud of mist along the horizon. The banks, I notice, have begun to recede. Soon they disappear from sight, but the water still loops and curls. I've got to fight the wheel to keep the boat straight. Through the wheelhouse portal, I see the envoy pointing off to starboard. There are thousands of leafless branches poking up like stubble on the water's surface. An underwater forest. This land must have flooded some time ago. Actually, he's not just pointing at the trees. There's something caught in one of the branches. Someone, floating, face down. I let off the gas and stare for a few seconds. Now Reed's at the cabin door, looking at me with wide eyes. He's pointing ahead. Coming out of the mist, I see a huge concrete tunnel, and then another. Dozens of them spidering out along the water's surface. I feel like we're looking down into some colossal pipe organ. And now above the tunnels, there's this hulking gray mass, hundreds of feet tall. It's got more towers than I could count, all connected by enclosed walkways. And everywhere it's sharp corners and blackened glass. This must be it, the first lock. I'd heard about this thing and pictured something dramatic. And this, it's dramatic.
All tunnels clear, but probably not for long. I'm getting grumbles and hinge squeal around the 200s down by the lock chamber. And Zelda, if you're anywhere near there, I'd start doubling back, get to at least one.
That voice on the radio must be coming from somewhere in those tunnels. More and more are poking out of the mist now, hundreds of them stretching as far as I can see. They're all filthy, the concrete smeared with grease and something else. I try to figure out which is the entrance, but there are no signs. Actually, they all seem to be pushing the water out. I throw the boat into reverse, but the current's too strong. The crew I see are already on their spots, Reed on the starboard stern and the envoy up on the bow. Both of them are holding their rebar, ready to keep us off the concrete. I choose a tunnel, grip the wheel tight, and aim the boat straight inside.
If I'd just stayed in Superior Land, right now I might be in my boat, drifting the banks of Buck Lake and casting for crappie at the mouth of my favorite culvert, that one under the Upper Rail tracks. But no, because as soon as she sent that letter, as soon as she told me I could find her on the highway, through the signal, I left. So now, instead of frying fillets and cracker crumbles and snack beer, here I am, in a culvert, and I kind of feel like someone might be casting for me. Huckins kills the engine. Reed and I hop to the gunwales and steady the boat against the walls. That sound, it's coming from somewhere close. I step up onto the bulkheads and see that the wheelhouse is nearly scraping the ceiling, and there, embedded in the concrete, is a grated circle that might be a speaker.
This is not a test. This is not a test. is what happens when you dig your fingertips into a face and expect it to smile. What happens when the proof is piling up but you're addicted to your own denial. This is what happens to a heartland when every artery is clogged with refugees. When the runaway slaves run straight to the armory, find the weapons and set them free. This is what happens. Call it an equal and opposite reaction. Ashes to ashes. My heroes are burning and getting stuck in my eyelashes. So I rock sunglasses through the nuclear winter. She always appreciated fashion. And this isn't an excuse or a justification. This is just what happens. So many of us are so close. All we need is one more push. So many of us are so close. So many, so all alone. So many of us are so close. All we need is one more push. So many of us are so close. And I'm not talking about home. I met a woman in a nightmare. I couldn't wake up, but she did. I couldn't figure out whose dream it was, so I pinched myself to pieces. And peace is meaningless in the absence of justice, so we willingly ride to war. And all I want is to say I'm sorry, but I'm not. Oh, and by the way, tunnels 3, 4, and 12 through 21 are flooding. Make your way to the 1200 markers. You've got 2 minutes.
I spin around and see Huckins looking back through the stern windows, one hand on the wheel. He's trying to reverse us out of here. And I mean, I guess that's the only option. This boat's way too long to turn around in such a narrow channel. Reed climbs on the deck beside me. He hears it too. Whatever that is coming fast.
1200's opening in 1 minute. I repeat, 1 minute.
I'm about to do what feels natural and have a 5-alarm panic attack when, up ahead, I see a faint flicker of light. Now it splits into 2 bobbing electric blue orbs. Flares. Someone or something is speeding toward us. I can see them just barely. It looks like 2 souped-up flatboats, each carrying a couple people. They're coming in hard, aimed straight at our bow. At the last second, they veer, one to either side. As they zip past, they set hooks on our gunwale rails. We lurch backward. Those boats may be small, but man, are they powerful.
1200's opening in 10 seconds.
We're flying backward now, way faster than this boat's ever gone. But the water's rising. Waves are rolling in, scraping the wheelhouse against the tunnel ceiling. I feel like we should be close to the entrance, but there doesn't even seem to be an entrance anymore. It's like it's been closed off, and I don't know where those flatboaters think they're taking.
Opening now. 15 seconds to override.
I lean around the wheelhouse just in time to see a hatch door slide open. Then another wave slams the hull, and I nearly get my head mashed between metal and concrete. The flatboaters slow and dart into that little doorway, still dragging us. Lurch to port and the hull bangs concrete hard, but we make it through and crash over a sort of fall into another tunnel where the water's lower. I sit on a bulkhead and catch my breath. There are steps on the gunwale and I assume it's Reed, but the figure that jumps down onto the deck is a woman clad in a greased black jumpsuit.
What the huckleberry? Just a moment ago, we were puttering down the Mississippi, but now we're deep in the belly of this concrete beast. Some river cruise this has turned out to be. These flatboaters who saved us, they don't look like much. Pale skin shimmers beneath their tattered attire. Seems ages since they last saw the sun. They sure move quick, though. I shimmy up the bow to find one of them already aboard our boat. Without a word of introduction, she steps into the cabin and sets to snooping about the pantry. Helps herself to a piece of salted bass and a healthy swig of brewed barley. Through a mouthful of half-chewed fish, she says her name is Zelda and tells us we sure chose the right tunnel. Without her crew, we'd be doomed like all the other errant floaters. Those who enter this lock rarely make it out alive.
It's on to you. Tunnel 6 is flooding in 5 minutes. Head up to 800 now.
Zelda leans over the rail and signals to her crew. The flatboats kick into gear, circle and pull our boat the other way, back into the tunnel.
4 minutes. And Zelda, I mean four.
That voice is deep and buttery, like how I imagined Father Mapple might sound. I ask Zelda who it is. Oh, Guante, she says. He's emergency dispatch, monitors water levels across the lock, and issues alerts when chambers begin to flood. If he does his job right, our crews have time to hotwire the valve gates, shift the tunnels before they submerge.
3 minutes.
The envoy is now beside me, jotting notes in his pocketbook. I ponder what could possibly come of all his scribbling. Zelda explains that it was the roaches who built this lock. Before I can even ask, she says, that's what they called us. What we call ourselves. Roaches.
2 minutes.
For generations, Zelda says, the roaches worked the locks, swinging gates and spinning valves, doing whatever the tower told them. She grew up with the faceless gaze of those tinted windows. But she's never been up there. As far as she knows, no one has.
1 minute.
One day, she continues, the reservoir started to rise.
The last words of a roach underfoot.
Families woke to water lapping their foundations and spilling into their cellars below.
Sometimes, we hear you tell your children that we're more afraid of you than of us.
Workers at the lock scrambled to open the valves, spill the swell, but all the control wheels were locked. A few of the elders climbed up top, tried to get to the tower, but they couldn't get inside. They couldn't even find doors.
Funny, you never tell them about the twisting, deafening darkness mere inches from your skull when you sleep, the orgy of legs and antennae no more than 10 feet from your naked toes.
So all they could do was climb the concrete wall and watch the water swallow their homes.
That every hour of the day, this hell is not where we live. This hell is what we are. And we are certainly not afraid. 1200's opening in 10 seconds.
Now she steps off our bow, back into the flatboat. The roaches, she calls out, came down into these tunnels because they'd worked them. They knew them. And one day, they'll take the tunnels back.
Opening now.
Beside us, another one of those portals swings open. The flatboats rocket us through the hatch, and it clamps shut just before the water hits.
I tie the bow line to a broken pipe that's cemented into the wall, and then step from the boat onto a concrete causeway. This tunnel's just like the last, except it's mostly dry. The water just barely deep enough for our boat. They've walled it off somehow and created a little sanctuary. A bit further up the tunnel, there's a figure standing beside a fire. It looks like he's speaking into a walkie-talkie.
Hey, I don't know why, I'm just the dispatcher, but Seymour said he needs it, a whole bucket full. Yeah, I guess it's actually pretty corrosive.
Now Zelda's beside me. She follows my gaze and asks if we'd like to meet Guante. He's standing beside a fire built in the shell of a wrecked flatboat. Behind him, near the opposite wall of the tunnel, there's a mess of bedrolls and seat cushions, tin cans and silverware. Zelda steps up and places a hand on Guante's shoulder.
Yeah, I'll do that one a cappella right after he cracks the hinges when y'all are... Hold on a second, Zelda's here.
Now Zelda introduces us as another band of travelers. Says we got lost in the tunnels. Guante sizes us up for a moment and then turns to Zelda and asks, traveling in what? She points back down the tunnel and Guante steps right around us. Trots over to our boat. He kicks the hull a few times, a little hard for my liking, and then climbs up to the deck, jumps up and down on the bulkheads. When he gets back to the fire, he says, "Yep, that'll work." I'm about to ask exactly what it'll work for, but then Guante says, "Come on, I want to show you something." He starts walking up the tunnel into the darkness and motions for us to follow. The envoy's got his little book out, and Reed's trying to walk alongside Guante, chat him up, though the causeway is only a couple feet wide. If they are expecting some sort of educational field trip, they're out of luck. Guante is just walking in silence, holding a flare in front of him. After a minute, the envoy, not the most patient guy, asks how they secured this tunnel, what they use it for. Guante just nods, and for a second, I think he's not going to respond. But then he raises up the walkie-talkie.
"You call this a wall? These people have crossed history and empires. We have watched them fall, and all in all, we've gotten stronger. We are the soil underneath every city you've conquered. We are the monsters abused by the conquerors, the conscripts in your army, fragging officers. We are the floodwaters from the origin, and ain't no brick in existence thick enough to hold us in. We are passing you by. You want to stop progress with an imaginary line? Well, a shanty is a fine home for a leader. You can even see it in the children's faces. This is displacement mixed with desperation, a Molotov cocktail of impatience. We want you to taste it. Unlit is just as well. Feel a rumble in your stomachs when you get to hell."
I notice he's trailing his fingers along the wall. There are these dark, mossy stains every 20 or 30 feet that wrap all the way around the tunnel. I can see a few more up ahead in the dim light of the flare, and they make me think of a tree's growth rings, how they'd look if they were pulled out and stacked on top of each other.
"They'll tell you have no heart. Your blood just sloshes from left to right when you walk, and my fingertips are sharp, and I don't need catharsis. I don't need closure. I just need to be a little closer for the screaming of the ghosts of everyone who never had this to erupt from my lips. It's over. We will not discuss this like gentlemen. This is genocide. We are desensitized. We are the set-aside, setting our sights on the enterprise. We were never meant to find. This is America, one big happy prison. But we wrote our names on the walls. You thought it was graffiti, but it was a sign to everyone looking, from those already inside. Over the top and under the radar, we are squeezing through your keyholes. We are leaking through the cracks in your foundation. We the people are over the top and under the radar. We are squeezing through your keyholes. We are leaking through the cracks in your foundations. We the people are over the top and under the radar. We are squeezing through your keyholes. We are leaking through the cracks in your foundation. We the people."
Guante drops the walkie-talkie to his side. He doesn't offer any more explanation, doesn't wait for applause, just keeps walking. Here we are, the end of the tunnel. Guante plays his flare across the slab of concrete in front of us. Its edges are darkened by dripping water, its face covered by dings and craters. And over on the opposite causeway, there's this pile of chain-strapped tree trunks, maybe battering rams. I turn back around and look at those stains. They really are growth rings. The roaches have been moving that slab forward, bit by bit. But how? Guante slips past me and starts walking down the causeway, back toward where we came from. Over his shoulder, he says, "We're gonna need your boat."
I'm up on the bow deck with Zelda and about 8 other roaches. We're in yet another tunnel, our motor off, floating in near silence. The roaches stand on the bulkheads, grabbing the concrete with suction rods, pulling us along. This tunnel, number 13, is one of 6 that empties right into the big guy, lock number 1. That's where we're headed. We've got a mission. I like missions. It seems the roaches do too. They've been running operations against the tower for years, doing all they can to drain that lock and claim another growth ring. They've short-wired circuitry, hand-cranked valves, even dynamited holes in the downstream doors. A lot of the time their plans don't work, and whenever they do, the tower just swings its doors and closes its valves, cuts off the latest line of attack.
So then the roaches come up with a new one.
Those of you in the single digits, I wouldn't go further than the 600 marker, 500 tops. I'm getting some weird echoes from the antechamber.
We're almost to the lock now. In tunnels all around us, a dozen others are out in flatboats, motoring loud and hard, getting the tower's attention. And one brave soul, name of Seymour, I believe, he's down in this subterranean alcove with wrenches and magnets and a bucket full of saliva, and he's working to... Okay, honestly, I wasn't really listening when they explained that part. I just know Seymour is going to do something to the hinges on the lock doors, and that we need to pry them apart just a bit until the water surges through and finishes the job. Ahead, there's a pinhole of light. This must be the lock. The first thing I notice is how huge the tower is. The lip of the lock is already 30 feet overhead, but I bet it's a quarter mile up to those ink-black windows. The water in the lock looks like motor oil and smells like a festering wound. It's full of debris and distant bobbing shapes, the nature of which I'd rather not consider.
This is the art of drawing breath, of making visible what has been invisible. This is a pragmatist's guide to faith. This is singing when you've forgotten how to pray. Welcome to this space. It's flooding every tunnel. Zelda, get to the doors now.
There's the lock horn, the signal Seymour promised to send. Huckins is ready at the helm, and he rams the throttle forward. This does pretty much nothing speed-wise, but at least it's awfully noisy.
Water level 85 feet.
They line up across the bow and wait as the boat lumbers toward the doors. Reed's right in there with them, holding a harpoon. I don't know how he always manages to find those things.
Know that you are not welcome here. We are all trespassers. We are not welcome here. This universe would like nothing more than for you to not exist, and the proof is in the history you live. Tell me this. What are the odds that this planet would appear in just the right place with the right atmosphere and geology? What are the odds that life would suddenly spark in the darkness from the carcass of this planet to a colony? What are the odds that this anomaly would spread? Water level 76 feet.
We're descending, fast, and still 100 feet from the doors.
Water level 71 feet.
The tower's emptying the lock, trying to beach us on the concrete, and we're dropping absurdly fast now, from 62 to 58 in what feels like a second.
Water level 55 feet.
But we're almost there. We might make it.
Water level 50 feet. And look, you don't need me to tell you that. It's right on the wall.
Just before we make it to the doors, I'd see them move, barely. Seymour's done his job.
What are the odds of what survive and stay ahead of volcanic eruptions, meteorites, and earthquakes? That first drum, first beat, first rhythm, first break, first time the notes broke to form a system. You could hear the first melody, the first multi-celled organism. What are the odds?
The water's dropping further. 30, 29, and these doors aren't giving at all. I've changed my mind. We're not gonna make it. This was a stupid idea, and I wish I just... The doors give. Now they blow wide open and we surge through. For a second, I'm ecstatic, but then the bow deck falls away under my feet and my gut jumps up my throat. This is a waterfall. We've made a waterfall. And now we're surfing over the edge, me and Reed and the roaches grabbing whatever we can, screaming, our limbs flailing. And somehow, over all of this, I can still hear Guante's voice thundering from above.
I see millennia trying to murder you. I see a thousand generations of pain and fear. I see struggle inscribed into your skeleton, and I see you still here.
The boat comes to rest on a sandy bank. Fireworks are going off in my knee, and the roaches are variously bleeding, but somehow it seems like everyone's here. We made it.
Ancestor armor. Star-crossed survivor, an unwelcome guest in a hostile environment. Defiance is your birthright. Fire from the first time you drew breath, the smile on your face. Welcome to this space. Know that you are not welcome here. We are all trespassers. We are not welcome here. So if our drawing breath is blasphemy, sin, or treason, let's keep drawing breath until there's nothing left to breathe in. We are the codes that our ancestors still speak in.
I was kind of hoping for a nice sappy goodbye, but the roaches just grab their tools and step from the deck to the beach. Immediately, they push our boat free, back into the river. I hop up onto a bulkhead and look down at Zelda and ask what they're doing. We hadn't discussed this part, the aftermath, but I kind of figured they'd come with us downriver, at least for a day or two. Zelda looks up, her face blank. "They'll go back to the tunnels," she says. "Do this again." She shoves us free of the sand. For a while we drift, watching as the roaches walk to the wall between the lock and dam. They begin climbing the concrete, quicker than even seems possible, almost like they're dancing up it. The current here is strong. Huckins tries to motor against it, but still we're pulled downstream. As we enter a river bend, the doors shutter, then begin to swing on their massive hinges.
This is not a test. 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 This is not.
Before they've even closed, I see water rushing in from upstream. In minutes, the lock will be full. The tunnels will flood. Just before we lose sight of the lock, its doors slam shut. If the roaches notice, they don't let on. They just keep climbing.
This week, the River Signal was inspired by our session and conversation with Guante. We recorded him on the Channel Princess Riverboat at Lock and Dam No. 1 in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Our second morning on the Mississippi, we wake early in the cottonwood-rimmed fishing hole we've named One Crane Cove. It's just a few miles from downtown St. Paul, but feels like a rural backwater. This morning, the cove is silent. Empty but for its namesake crane, who's tiptoeing through shoreline reeds. We're all pretty groggy, having stayed up late recording an old-time band, but we roll out of our bunks, drop anchor lines, and motor out of the cove. We're headed upstream to Lock and Dam No. 1, where we're going to record a session with Guante, a Minneapolis MC, spoken word poet, and activist. Guante is an incredibly busy guy. If he's not performing his own stuff, he's organizing a youth poetry slam, or speaking at a rally, or hopefully sleeping sometimes. We've made plans to meet Guante at 10 a.m. on a sandy little beach in Minnehaha Park. But as we approach, we realize the little beach is actually a pile of rocks at the base of a cliff. Guante's cool about it. He finds a spot to scramble down, waits patiently to be picked up from shore, and even manages not to laugh when we bust a window with a dinghy oar. And when we pull into the lock, he's ready to perform.
They found Superman's body behind a Chinese buffet, cape over his head wedged between dumpsters. And I ain't dude's biggest fan, but two kryptonite bullets, it's just messed up that he went out like such a sucker, just got bucked like one of us would, but it's poetic justice he die in Southside Metropolis. Look up in the sky, ain't no birds, no planes, and no solutions, just a permanent curtain of smog, flicker to life by light pollution, like Superman was a hero to most, but he never meant much to me. Little more than a prisoner with a life sentence, honoring us roaches with his friendship. But look who he defended, policy, property, and investments, their truth, justice, and American way. But that was never our direction, forcing to look into the sky for protection that never came as he battled robots for the status quo, not for the people, and tried to spin it into good versus evil. But this is not a movie for us, trying to one-take life. Don't look for the sequel, look for the steeple. Ring every bell as though God had fallen and was fertilizing hell. We are not faithful. We just know flight does not make you an angel. The day after Superman died, everybody stopped looking up in the sky and started looking down at the ground like we have been heroes here this whole time. The day after Superman died, everybody just got back on the grind because there was work to be done. No cakes, but we stay fly. Because my hero is the janitor who organizes after-school programs in his off time, right? My hero is the amateur rapper who only makes $20 but spits all night. My hero is the independent journalist working under pressure that I can't imagine. My hero has got to be that single mother working two jobs yet still finding time to splash the canvas. My hero, the union organizer who stays disillusioned but he keeps moving. He says it's for the movement, and even if he doesn't live to see it, he'll make improvements for his kids. Believe it, my hero is not a household name. She just runs a household day after day. No excuses. Her superpowers, dinner made on minimum wage for two teens and a first generation college student. My heroes are refugees, undocumented workers sending money back home, conscious thugs, gay rappers, and hip hop feminists who never had nothing but a dream and some backbone. And none of us wear capes. None of us will ever be president. None of us will ever be Superman. We can only jump so high. But feet to the earth, we are so fly. The day after Superman died, everybody stopped looking up in the sky and started looking down at the ground like we have been heroes here this whole time. Again, I work in short form, right? So a poem is usually 3 minutes long, a song is usually 3 minutes long. And so you don't maybe get a ton of time to set the table, so to speak, in terms of setting and place. So you have to be really, really efficient with the descriptors that you use. And so trying to describe a setting for a thing that's happening in a very short song might be one line, might be one image. And I do try to be super intentional about that, but it's definitely a challenge with short form writing, I think. Characters are composites, and to some extent, and I'm like, I might get dragged for this, but I think sometimes characters are less characters and more like allegorical plot movers. And I think in a 3 minute piece of art, I think that's okay. I think in a novel you don't want that, but I think sometimes working with allegory, even if that takes away maybe a little bit from the realism of the characters, I think that's okay. I was struck by lightning. Not as a figure of speech, I was literally struck by lightning. It smells like a hospital on fire, like the cleanest smoke you can imagine, like spring water pulled apart by the atoms. It smells like recycled air on an airplane crashing. What are the odds? It didn't give me superpowers. So I guess I gotta take my chances with small talk, weather reports, and high traffic, with time clocks and time bombs and time passing. When I'm not here anymore, will my planet even notice my absence? I swear. Some days are like carving your name into the Capitol with just your fingernails while the politicians laugh at you, and some days are worse. I want to leave a legacy so they'll remember me for more than this verse. Please hold your applause. Hold it forever. There is so much that keeps us apart and so little that holds us together. But whatever that is, we're gonna need it. It's gonna get worse before it gets better. And it only gets better when we do better. And we only do better when we fuse together. Yes, there is no progress without struggle. Whether you're an activist or just a kid in some trouble, a student graduating with debt, a single mother depressed, a little brother repressed, dripping the sun as it sets into a habit hidden under the bed while four walls echo something I said. When dark clouds gather, remember to just fight back. Not everyone can be touched or struck like that and survive. But you did, and still got this spark inside, so use it. See, I've learned a little bit about energy. I've learned when it enters you, it loses charge. So the negative and positive are worth the same amount. The passion and the pain, the smiles and the scars. Whether you lost your job or won the lottery, that energy enters you like a lightning bolt. And no matter how dark its origin, once it's inside you, it is yours to control. So what this means is that those who've been through the most have the most to let go. There is strength in our anger, power in our pain, even beauty in the hourglass's grains. It all depends on how we use it, right? Some people make music. Some people make excuses. Some people make enemies. Some make believe. Some people make the most of every tragedy. And me, I'm just trying to make a scene. Not gonna patiently wait for my pain to bury me. Not gonna patiently wait to try to get popularity or prosperity. I'd rather stand tall in solidarity with everyone we've lost, because they're never lost. And every one of y'all who stays forever strong, and will build baselines out of thunder, rap to the rhythm of the rain, and dance on the little bit of space that we have, and build something lasting as this empire is collapsing. And when they ask me to come along quietly, I'll say, how can I quit? I got lightning inside of me.
Art, and I mean especially poetry and double especially spoken word, is all about is like how we take our very specific experiences, because the specificity is what makes them real and what makes them engaging to an audience, and how we move that into a space of, one, how can it relate to multiple people that don't share that specific experience, but also how can it comment on these larger ideas and larger themes. So yeah, I think that's a big part of it, is like we have to always be honest, but we don't always have to tell the truth. Because I think sometimes just telling the truth can be kind of boring, right? But it still has to come from an honest place inside. It still has to be what you authentically are about and what you believe in. And so that's what I try to do with my work, is tell the truth, but in a really weird, interesting, hopefully engaging way. I'm super contrarian, and I think so much of both hip-hop culture and spoken word culture is about the, the kind of testimonial, the confessional. Like, everyone assumes, even though we know this to be false, that when a rapper tells you about a thing that he's done, that it's true. Or when a spoken word poet tells you about something that they've experienced, that it's true. And I think what we forget is both hip-hop and spoken word are just other kinds of writing, and we can be as creative, we're as free to be as creative and as weird and as imaginative as we can possibly be with them. And so I think characterization and narrative and just, you know, storytelling, there's a long tradition of hip-hop storytelling, which I think is really important.
It's hard to be the cool kid at a funeral. Skinny black tie, black shoes. It's a beautiful October afternoon. I watch a plane overhead, full of human beings who have no idea that you're... I guess life goes on. No offense. And now I'm trying not to laugh, which makes me want to laugh. Now I don't mean no disrespect as I step into this funeral home, like light through stained glass, like light through black holes, like light that faded ages ago, like my phone on airplane mode. Like, I don't believe in ghosts, but I swear I feel a buzz, a voicemail from the nothing where something was. I'm still laughing. I can't pretend like I'm not sad. It's just that lack of touch is not the same as lack of contact, and that Grim Reaper isn't that powerful. You can't change the past, and your impact is unstoppable. I don't think you die when you die. I don't think we really understand what it means to be alive, much less existence and much less time. We think that there's no time, but maybe there's no time, and maybe memory and prophecy are intertwined. Maybe the present is a pixel in a much larger design, if the system's resolution is a trillion by a trillion, but the CPU display is only one by one. Well, then it's easy to assume there's nothing but the room in which we hide and not a whole universe outside. I don't know if any of this makes sense. I don't know if I should end it with an amen. I just know there's a river in every raindrop, and a lot of raindrops in that riverbed. I said, I just know there's a river in every raindrop, and a lot of raindrops in that riverbed.
The lock is immense. Our boat's not. You could probably fit about 200 Channel Princesses in here and still have room to spare. High overhead, there's a labyrinth of ladders and towers with tinted windows and gangways full of sightseers who stop and point down at us. We must look so funny. Four guys crowded around a microphone on the bow of a little toy boat. The doors shut and we begin to descend through the lock. The riverside trees disappear behind the concrete, water splashes and swirls, and the echoes get more echoey. It's cool, and also kind of unsettling. I can't help but feel like we're being lowered into a villain's lair, something out of a Bond movie. It's the perfect setting for Guante's spoken word. So many of his poems are about power and resistance, and it's a pretty amazing thing, watching him bob around the mic, growling up at those towers. When the locked doors open, he keeps going, unfazed, as we motor out of the lock, float downstream, and beach the boat in a sandy island. we find a spot in front of the falls of the dam and record some more.
The last words of a roach underfoot. Sometimes we hear you tell your children that we're more afraid of you than you are of us. Funny, you never tell them about the twisting, deafening darkness mere inches from your skull when you sleep, the orgy of legs and antennae no more than 10 feet from your naked toes at every hour of the day. This hell is not where we live. This hell is what we are. And we are certainly not afraid. See, we may not be very smart, but our love is brilliant, twitchy and chattering inside the walls, just beyond the reach of your creeping sunrise. Our love can see in the dark. Yes, we run when the lights are turned on, but it's not out of fear. It's just that we prefer some atmosphere. We find love in the places you don't want to admit exist, and we know of a deeper kind of bond than flowers and pop songs. She kisses me like candy dropped under the refrigerator. She kisses me frantically with a passion too easily confused for starvation. See, over millennia, we've learned that every second smiling, whispering something beautiful, or feeling glorious is a second not spent intertwined like fingers in prayer. She kisses me like survival through winters, through boots and rolled up newspapers, through bombs and nerve gas. Our love may not inspire songs or fairy tales, but we will hold on to it long after every one of your singers and storytellers are dead, and it won't be beautiful, but we will still be here, and no one will see us, but we will still be here. She kisses me like we won't be. And there are days when she's halfway right, but we always find a way. We always have, and we've been listening to you. You who say this can be something greater than necessity, that love can be something greater than the complex interplay of chemicals in the brain, that life can be something greater than survival. But what could be greater than survival? Keep your plastic-coated greeting cards, expensive shiny rocks, consolidated DVD libraries, and whispered I love yous in the rain. Keep them. We have no need for this. This love has no need for props. We don't even have lips. She kisses me everywhere with everything. So go ahead and turn the lights on. We dare you. What you call night is just a fumigation tent over the earth, and the stars are your last hallucination before the poison pools in your rotted lungs and overtakes you. We will dance on your insides. Our children will inherit your homes. And a million years from now, when your species is extinct and all of your songs and poems and joys and struggles and heartbreaks are forgotten, we will still be here, intertwined, surviving, a billion of us in the dark places you will always be afraid of.
There's been this more recent trend towards post-apocalyptic fiction, but I also look at like older stuff like magical realism, you know, like Gabriel Garcia Marquez and stuff like that, where it's a world that we recognize, but things are just subtly different about it. And I think that subtle difference is where it's such an effective way to capture people's attention. At least, I mean, I speak for myself as a reader and as a listener and as someone who engages and ingests a lot of art. Those moments where you're looking at a picture and then everything's normal and then suddenly something is not normal anymore, for me, it helps me notice everything, not just the one thing that sticks out, but it helps me notice the whole big picture. So I think for me, it's a tactical thing as a writer. How do you get people to care about stuff beyond just standing up on a stage and being like, hey, everyone, racism is bad. All the things that people generally want to write about, right, are like death and family and loss and sadness and war and racism and issues and blah, blah, blah. And these are all super abstract. And if you just say those things, they don't really mean anything. So I think the step one for me and for a lot of the you know, artists that I work with and students I work with is, how do we take those ideas and make them real? How do we put a human face on them? And then from there, that's when you can tell the story.
You call this a war. These people have crossed history and empires. We have watched them fall, and all in all, we've gotten stronger. We are the soil underneath every city you've conquered. We are the monsters abused by the conquerors, the conscripts in your army fragging officers. We are the floodwaters from the origin, and ain't no brick in existence thick enough to hold us in. We are passing you by. You want to stop progress with an imaginary line? Well, a shanty is a fine home for a leader. You can even see it in the children's faces. This is displacement mixed with desperation, a Molotov cocktail of impatience. We want you to taste it. Unlit is just as well. Feel a rumble in your stomachs when you get to hell. You call this a headshot? I can still smell you, and I can still tell you have no heart. Your blood just sloshes from left to right when you walk, and my fingertips are sharp. And I don't need catharsis, I don't need closure, I just need to be a little closer for the screaming of the ghosts of everyone who never had this to erupt from my lips. It's over. We will not discuss this like gentlemen. This is genocide. We are desensitized. We are the set aside, setting our sights on the enterprise we were never meant to find. This is America, one big happy prison, but we wrote our names on the walls. You thought it was graffiti, but it was a sign to everyone looking, from those already inside. Over the top and under the radar, we are squeezing through your keyholes. We are leaking through the cracks in your foundation. We the people are over the top and under the radar. We are squeezing through your keyholes. We are leaking through the cracks in your foundations. We the people are over the top and under the radar. We are squeezing through your keyholes. We are leaking through the cracks in your foundation, we the people.
It's been proven, both in terms of just experience, but also like cognitively, that people do not listen to you when you just tell them stuff. Like when you say, the statistics show that blah, 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 like it does not change people's minds. And so the only way to change people's minds is through putting a human face on these ideas, and through metaphor, and through storytelling. In a general sense, like the work that I want to do is, how can we very explicitly and directly talk about these issues, but do it in a way that doesn't put people to sleep or doesn't make them super defensive right away? You know, one example of that is Minnesota was the first state to defeat a referendum to ban same-sex marriage. After like 30 other states, it had passed in all these other states, and Minnesota pushed it back because, I mean, for various reasons, but I think one of those reasons was that the organization who was kind of spearheading that campaign was very, very explicit about, we're not gonna just say, like, here are the economic impacts of same-sex marriage, or here are the constitutional reasons why it should not be outlawed. They were gonna say, we're gonna tell stories. We're gonna place advertisements on TV and newspaper, on the radio, that's just someone saying like, hey, this is my uncle, and this is why I want to vote no on this referendum. And it worked. And I think that is a really important lesson that I've learned and that a lot of people are learning. I think what that does too, it emphasizes every individual's like agency, like the power that we have, not as people who are within like the tides of history, but as people who make those tides. I think that's something that's really easy to forget. Alternate history is a way of kind of making that power that is so often invisible and making it visible, and being like, if these people or this one person or this one group didn't do this one thing at this one time, like think of everything that would be completely different and how that can relate to then ourselves in the present. I think that's really powerful.
I met a horse in the Midwest, black as the midnight, fast as the sunset. She was the one breath left in the lungs of the country we rode on. Every road was a drumbeat. So I nod my head as if I agreed leaving was common sense, and every city would burn, the smoke would creep higher. But we ride smoke and I can breathe fire. No regrets, no apologies, and no symptoms of what I carried along with me. In the damp, foggy midnight, one horseman courses, doing the work of four. Story of my life, no spite, this is righteous after a fashion. This is justice after a fashion. This is America, this is madness. This is what happens when you dig your fingertips into a face face and expected to smile. What happens when the proof is piling up, but you're addicted to your own denial? This is what happens to a heartland when every artery is clogged with refugees, when the runaway slaves run straight to the armory, find the weapons, and set them free. This is what happens. Call it an equal and opposite reaction. Ashes to ashes. My heroes are burning and getting stuck in my eyelashes, so I rock sunglasses through the nuclear winter. She always appreciated fashion, and this isn't an excuse or a justification. This is just what happens. So many of us are so close. All we need is one more push. So many of us are so close. So many, so all alone. So many of us are so close. All we need is one more push. So many of us are so close. And I'm not talking about home. I met a woman in a nightmare. I couldn't wake up, but she did. I couldn't figure out whose dream it was, so I pinched myself to pieces. And peace is meaningless in the absence of justice, so we willingly ride to war. And all I want is to say I'm sorry, but I'm not. So where do you go when you've run out of road and the road is the only home you've ever known? It's like I'm trapped in amber. She gives me a smile instead of an answer, and I take it. Yeah, so I'm not a super outdoorsy person. Even as a kid, I wasn't super outdoorsy. But then, you know, family always loved to go fishing and stuff. I never really liked fishing, but I liked being on the water. Like, if I could just be here without having to, like, touch animals, that's great. I like that. Because I had friends who had boats, and you got to hang out somewhere. You may as well hang out on a boat. And not like a boat, but like a, what do they call? Like a little, not a canoe, bigger than a canoe, smaller than a boat. I guess they're just called boats, right? See, you can tell right now, I don't really know what I'm talking about. This is the art of drawing breath, of making visible what has been invisible. This is a pragmatist's guide to faith. This is singing when you've forgotten how to pray. Welcome to this space. Know that you are not welcome here. We are all trespassers. We are not welcome here. This universe would like nothing more than for you to not exist, and the proof is in the history you live. Tell me this. What are the odds that this planet would appear in just the right place with the right atmosphere and geology? What are the odds that life would suddenly spark in the darkness from the carcass of this planet to a colony? What are the odds that this anomaly would spread? What are the odds it would survive and stay ahead of volcanic eruptions, meteorites, and earthquakes? That first drum, first beat, first rhythm, first break, first time the notes broke to form a system. You could hear the first melody, the first multi-celled organism. What are the odds this first environment to harbor life would meet another, maybe fight or maybe harmonize, but either way it would evolve. So what are the odds it would evolve to walk and not crawl, to fly and not fall, to survive every single mass extinction? What are the odds of your existence? How many generations did it take to make you? How many plagues, wars, and massacres conspired to uproot your family tree and salt the earth around it? How many ancestors carried your fire? How many farmers made it through the famine? How many runaway slaves got away? How many soldiers conscripted deserted? How many times did that chain almost break? How did your great-great-grandparents meet? What was the song playing when you were conceived? Is it inconceivable, the happenstance inherent in this life you have inherited? See, some see the elegance, complexity of bodies or the natural beauty of this planet and they say it's godly. There's gotta be divine intelligence behind it all, because the odds that you would make it on your own are so small. But me, I see millennia trying to murder you. I see a thousand generations of pain and fear. I see struggle inscribed into your skeleton, and I see you still here. Ancestor armor. Star-crossed survivor, an unwelcome guest in a hostile environment. Defiance is your birthright. Fire from the first time you drew breath, the smile on your face. Welcome to this space. Know that you are not welcome here. We are all trespassers, we are not welcome here. So if our drawing breath is blasphemy, sin, or treason, let's keep drawing breath until there's nothing left to breathe in. We are the codes that our ancestors still speak in.
We head to shore and drop Guante at the mouth of Minnehaha Creek, watch as he climbs up the bank toward the city. And then we push off from the sand and head downstream, looking back at the lock until we round a river bend and it disappears behind the trees.
This episode of The River Signal was written and recorded by Galen Huckins, Brian Benson, and Reed Lustig. Audio editing by Joel Shupak. Special thanks to Guante, Seymour Perspective, Zelda Schwartz, Ear Trumpet Labs, and KBOO 90.7. For pictures and video of the riverboat trip, and a video of Guante performing A Pragmatist's Guide to Faith inside Lock and Dam No. 1, go to riversignal.com. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for Episode 6.
Attention KBOO members and listeners. The KBOO Foundation is seeking to fill 4 upcoming vacancies on the Board of Directors. Terms run 3 years, beginning on October 1st. The nomination packet, due July 11th, is posted on the KBOO website and paper copies are available at the station. Candidates must submit the completed nomination packet via email to kboocommunity@gmail.com or mail or drop off the completed nomination packet, care of Timothy Welp, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Incomplete forms will not be considered as fulfilling the statement of interest requirement by the KBOO bylaws. Packets are due by Saturday, July 11th. The candidate statements submitted as part of the nomination packet will be posted to KBOO's website, and candidates will be expected to participate in an interview for broadcast and a Q&A session at the annual meeting. For more information, please contact the nominating committee at kboocommunity@gmail.com.